This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ihayes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's designed again in a way that it could be taken to field for research and they can process their samples on the field and, of course, get the results within 40 minutes.
That was Professor Tunde Salako, the Director General of the Nigerian Institute of Medical Research, on a proposed new quick test for COVID-19. Details coming up also. Mali has a new interim president. And in speeches at the UN General Assembly, African leaders are urging the international community to unite in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Mali has an interim president. 70-year-old former defense minister Colonel Bah Ndaw was sworn in today, tasked with presiding over an 18-month transition back to civilian rule following an August 18th military coup. Reuters reports that Colonel Assimi Goïta, head of the military junta for the past 8 weeks, was sworn in as transitional vice president at a ceremony in Bamako. Reuters reported that Bah Ndaw was chosen as interim president because he is well respected both in the military and among the general public. He is also said to get along well with Goïta, who led the coup. Portraying a unified front will be central to the success of Ndaw and Goïta. Any perception that the interim president is not really in charge could lead to renewed international pressure on the junta. Officials hope the inauguration will help Mali's West African neighbors lift economic sanctions they imposed after President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta's overthrow. Also watching will be members of the opposition M5RFP coalition, which organized mass protests against the ousted leader, but now are feeling sidelined in the process of appointing a replacement. A Nigerian research institute says it is seeking approval for a molecular test kit for COVID-19 that can produce results in 40 minutes. Mike Mbonye reports from Lagos.
Professor Tunde Salako is the Director General of the Nigerian Institute of Medical Research. He says the test kit, known as NIM-SARS-CoV-2 Isothermal Molecular Assay, was developed between March and September with funding from the Private Faith Philanthropic Foundation Coalition Against the Pandemic. Salako says the test kit is aimed at decentralizing COVID-19 testing away from the big laboratories to small hospitals and tertiary health institutions.
Tests will be available to many people, especially people who are going for surgery or for other things within the hospital that the surgeons needed to know the status of that individual. More importantly, for people who may want to do some kind of field research. It's designed again in a way that it could be taken to field for research and they can process their samples on the field and, of course, get the results within 40 minutes.
Salako says he's hoping for validation by health institutions in Nigeria and other African countries and that mass production could begin in 4 weeks.
So we believe that following standardization and validation and acceptance by most Nigerian and African institutions and laboratories, this will be one way to upscale COVID-19 testing for case detection in Nigeria and Africa.
Dr. Livinus Abonyi, a lecturer at the University of Lagos College of Medicine, calls the test kit a welcome development.
The institute has been at the forefront in the testing and management of COVID, and there is no doubt that at this point they have announced that they have a test kit functional, though it has not been verified or used by other counterparts to authenticate the efficacy. But standing by their reputation and the crop of scientists therein, we don't have any doubt that the kit will go a long way in effectively detecting and diagnosing COVID-19.
Salako said he could ramp up to mass production of the test kit in 4 weeks. He says institutions wishing to use it will need to buy T16 isothermal machines for which the kit was designed to be used. Salako says the institute is also among those working on a COVID-19 vaccine. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
Speaking in recorded messages played at the United Nations General Assembly, African leaders, including Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, urged the international community to unite in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. Also, in a recorded message, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari said, it's time the UN Security Council include African nations in their decision-making process. Tom Scali reports for Reuters.
Severely undermined.
Uhuru Kenyatta has warned that competition between global powers threatens to undermine efforts to tackle the coronavirus pandemic.
They have caused severe anxiety and undermined coordinated responses to an economic and social character that would have left us in a stronger position as a global collective.
The Kenyan president, speaking in pre-recorded comments at the United Nations General Assembly, called for the international community to remain anchored in multilateralism with a unity of purpose.
Mr. President.
He was one of several leaders bringing an African perspective on the pandemic. On Tuesday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa called for the international community to roll out a comprehensive stimulus package for the continent.
This will enable African countries to not only mitigate the health impacts of COVID-19, but to aid us in the immense task of rebuilding our shattered economies.
The General Assembly also heard from Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
We need to cooperate.
He said it was time to open up UN Security Council decision-making to African countries to reflect the diversity and dynamics of the 21st century.
Africa deserves permanent seats in the United Nations Security Council.
And he called for the international community to do more to eradicate poverty and fight multinational crime.
Cameroon President Paul Biya and Sudan President Salva Kiir are also scheduled to address the General Assembly today. Saturday is World Contraception Day, set aside by the UN to emphasize the importance of sexual and reproductive health and family planning and to support providers of that care for women and girls everywhere. This year, the challenges to universal access to contraception and family planning are far greater than usual due to COVID-19. The pandemic has interrupted the supply chains for contraceptive medicine and devices and left routine gynecological and obstetric care harder to get, sometimes with deadly consequences. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Susan Pop, Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, a global NGO dedicated to the health and well-being of women and girls. Ms. Pop began the interview by bluntly stating the simple truth.
Just because COVID has happened, people don't stop having sex and they don't stop having babies. But what we are finding is that there's been a disruption in access to sexual and reproductive health and rights services. And this disruption maps very well to what kind of disruption we saw in Africa with Ebola several years ago.
How so?
Supply chains are compromised. Services like access to contraception, wellness visits around family planning, access to safe abortion. And in some places where you have particularly strained health systems in Africa, sexual and reproductive health and rights services fall off because these systems are so strained.
Because of COVID?
Yes.
So what's the upshot of that? How does this falling off affect women?
So the Guttmacher Institute is a think tank. They, along with some UN agencies, have conducted a number of estimates on what it means when sexual and reproductive health and rights services are disrupted. As a result of these disruptions, 50 million more women have an unmet need for contraception. 16 million women are going to have unintended pregnancies. 200 million will experience major obstetric complications. And 1,000 additional maternal deaths are estimated to happen as a result of disruptions in services around reproductive and sexual health. So it's really alarming, the downstream effects of COVID, particularly to girls and women.
What is the remedy you suggest to right this balance?
I would say the UN systems and the governments need to recognize that sexual and reproductive health and rights are an essential part of services, that it's a non-negotiable. The UN General Assembly had several political statements that are going before all of the member states. One is an omnibus statement on COVID, and that omnibus statement rightly understands the gender dimensions of COVID. And so that's a positive sign. The World Health Organization also recognized the gender dimensions of COVID. The UN Secretary General has put out a COVID response and recovery plan that has gender dimensions included. But I think what we really need to ensure is that those aren't just words on a page, that it leads to action. And that action comes down to country leaders recognizing the normative guidance from the UN and following through on it.
That was Susan Popp, Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Paul Rusesabagina, who was portrayed as a hero in the Hollywood movie Hotel Rwanda, is facing a maximum 25 years in prison. The man, who now is a Belgian citizen and a U.S. permanent resident, is charged with 13 offenses in its native Rwanda, including financing terrorism, complicity in murder, recruiting child soldiers, and forming a rebel group. His family says he was kidnapped while he was in Dubai. The Associated Press reported that he looked frail during his first court appearance Friday when he admitted he backed a rebel group but denied supporting violence or killings. The denial of bail has alarmed his family, along with some human rights and legal groups who have expressed concern that his arrest is the latest example of Rwanda targeting critics. Rusesabagina is credited with saving more than 1,000 lives during the 1994 genocide. He was awarded the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom. But he has faced criticism from Rwandan authorities for speaking out against alleged human rights abuses by President Kagame's government. Zimbabwe's energy regulating authority has substantially hiked power tariffs as the government grapples with an economy tittering on the brink of collapse. Adigando gives us more on the story.
The Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, ZESA, announced yesterday a 50% hike. Effective 2 days ago, domestic consumers who were paying less than $200 for the first 200 units of power each month will now be paying more than $324. Energy and Power Development Minister Soda Jemo says delays in reviewing electricity tariffs have left ZESA with US$82.6 million in debt. Coal suppliers are also threatening to stop deliveries to a subsidiary, the Zimbabwe Power Company. And there is a huge water bill from the Zimbabwe Water Authority. According to the minister, the power utility can neither service nor buy boilers and transformers or secure oils and chemicals that are supposed to be paid in US dollars due to the low tariffs. The government says electricity tariffs should be at Zimbabwean dollar 844.3 cents per kilowatt, but currently stand at $19.3 per kilowatt. Takaba Firajou, president of the Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, PTUZ, says the hike will further strain low teacher salaries. The union recently said its members cannot afford to be back in classrooms when the government plans to reopen schools this week. The union's president weighs in.
the tariffs are not so much bad. But when connected to a lot of other things that have gone wrong and the starvation salary, then it is highly unfair coming from the same government that is failing to increase the salaries of teachers.
The government maintains that its tariffs are the lowest in the region and that adjustments have not been done since April, despite cabinet approval. It says tariff levels have actually fallen instead of going up. Economic analyst Prosper Chitambara says the increase will hit businesses and have a domino effect since electricity is a key input in the production and service chains such as tourism, mining, agriculture and manufacturing.
In the interest of ensuring viability on the part of ZESA, the parastatal, I think it became necessary to hike the tariff.
Bulawayo residents say the hikes are a bitter pill to swallow. Entrepreneur Rise Moyo weighs in.
It's just an addition of so many things that are rising up, and everybody has one legitimate response to it. You ask them, they will tell you that they are hiking because business environment forces them to do that. And everybody sounds reasonable, except when it comes to workers.
The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Union, the workers' mother body, calls the hikes a brutal attack on the working class. The organization's president, Peter Mtaza, says the government has turned its back on the working class.
We cannot allow a situation where the government allows prices of goods and services to be pegged against the US dollar and the exchange rate, while at the same time brutally refusing to have workers' salaries pegged in US dollars.
Mtaza says food, medical aid, and other basic necessities are out of reach for most people. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
In Zimbabwe, the government has been working to reopen schools that have been shut for most of the year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Primary and secondary school teachers say they will not be back at work until they are paid U.S. dollars. Now, workers at state universities demand they get pay increases before reopening classrooms. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi has more from Harare.
In a joint letter, the Zimbabwe State University Staff Associations told the Ministry of Higher and Tertiary Education they did not have enough money to return to work when universities reopen. The association said the minister had not attended a recent meeting at his boardroom and only relayed a message that university workers should be patient. However, the minister, Professor Amon Murira, says otherwise.
I saw a copy of the letter that they wrote. It's not true that I refused to meet them because I could not be at two places at one go. We did not have an appointment. I was with the Equatorial Guinea delegation for 2 days.
The minister said there is no divergence whatsoever between government and the tertiary institution workers.
There's no conflict at all. The issue of salaries is being looked at. This is the season for negotiation. And what is very important also is that the employer of universities are councils. And the minister is only there to give policy direction and backup where it's necessary.
The minister said pay increases are inevitable. However, Munyara Dzidodo, editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament business and political developments in Zimbabwe, says the government is in a fix.
The government is just eager to catch up with the education calendar and it doesn't want to roll over to next year because there'll be a huge cost. They have a huge salary bill. The lecturers and the University Workers Association are correct. Their salaries have now been eroded. The value has been eroded. So it's a catch-22 for the government. And I think it's going to be a stalemate. It's going to be a strike. And I don't see those universities opening. And if they do open, I don't see them functioning properly because I don't think any worker right now would go back under these current conditions and without a clear plan of how the government will support them.
There are growing calls by Zimbabwe workers to be paid in US dollars or have their salaries increased to match the high cost of living. Zimbabwe has experienced runaway inflation in the past months and its domestic RTGS currency has fallen in value. As a result, most people have seen their buying power dramatically eroded. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Citing a lawyer and the International Federation for Human Rights, Reuters reports that Paris prosecutors have opened an investigation into French bank BNP Paribas over allegations of complicity in crimes against humanity in Sudan. The probe comes after 9 Sudanese plaintiffs claiming they were victims of rights abuses by ousted President Omar al-Bashir's government filed a legal complaint last year against BNP Paribas. They allege the French bank was complicit in crimes against humanity because it provided financial services for the Sudanese government. They argue that in a U.S. sanctions violations case, the U.S. Department of Justice described BNP Paribas as Sudan's de facto central bank from 1997 to 2007 because it gave the government access to international money markets and the means to pay staff, the military and security forces. BNP Paribas said the bank had no information regarding the report and was therefore not in a position to comment. Conflict in Sudan's Darfur region ignited in 2003, where Sudanese forces waged a campaign of violence that killed more than 300,000 people. UN investigators warn peace in South Sudan and the future of its people are being compromised by deeply entrenched government corruption. The UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan has submitted its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The report presents a deeply disturbing picture of a country mired in crooked schemes aimed at enriching the political elite at the expense of millions of impoverished people who are bearing the scars of years of conflict and abuse. Commission Chair Yasmin Suka says South Sudan is a country where lives are being destroyed by financial corruption on an epic scale. She says looting and pillage are not just offshoots of war. They are the main drivers of the conflict.
At one end of the spectrum, South Sudan's political elites are fighting for control of the country's oil and mineral resources, in the process stealing their people's future. At the other, the soldiers in this conflict over resources are offered the chance to abduct and rape women in lieu of their salaries.
Suka says the commission has uncovered brazen embezzlement by senior politicians and the government. She says they have misappropriated a staggering $36 million since 2016. She says the number of international corporations and multinational banks have aided and abetted in these crimes. The report documents widespread human rights violations and internecine situations that are tearing communities apart and fueling ethnic and religious hatred. All this, it says, is depressing efforts to truly establish a peaceful government of unity. The commission says the establishment of the hybrid court, composed of judges and prosecutors from South Sudan and across Africa, is the only way to end the country's crisis. South Sudan's Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, Ruben Mado Arol, acknowledges his country's checkered human rights record. However, he says his government does not condone any form of violence, and human rights violations committed against civilians have reduced significantly. He says his government has established an economic management committee to address the country's difficult economic situation.
The committee is tasked to streamline the collection of non-oil revenues and monitor all financial transactions for transparency and accountability. With this, we are sure that it will produce good outcomes that will enable the government to focus on developmental projects.
The Justice Minister says the government is committed to the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. He appeals to the international community to provide the necessary support to enable his country to realize this. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abbaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.